Case number 07-1426 et al. Ad hoc Telecommunications Users Committee Petitioner versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Ms. Boothby for Petitioner Ad hoc Telecommunications. Mr. Wright for Petitioner Sprint Nextel et al. Mr. Welch for Respondent FCC and Mr. Nuchelin for Interveners AT&T et al.
May it please the Court, I'm Colleen Boothby, and I represent the Ad Hoc Telecommunications Users Committee. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I will be arguing that the FCC erred in this case by failing to assess competition in local access markets before granting forbearance for access services. My co-counsel will address the FCC's misplaced reliance on the availability of certain TDM-based services that are not adequate substitutes for the foreborne services. The Ad Hoc Telecommunications Users Committee is a group of large customers of telecom services. We have no carrier members. We accept no carrier funding. We approach these issues from the perspective of a customer. We are challenging, Ad Hoc is challenging this decision because it adversely affects end users as well as competitors of the incumbent local exchange carriers or ILACs. I'd like to begin by describing the services that enterprise customers, as the carriers refer to us, or corporate customers buy, because that is the source of the FCC's error in this case. The FCC relied on competition in the nationwide market for long-distance services, inter-exchange services, long-distance services, to find that competition exists for the special access services that are offered within exchanges. And that is a non sequitur. The FCC did not acknowledge the differences between these services. It just referred generically to broadband services. Broadband is a fashionable term in policy circles these days, but it is a sloppy term, and it led to sloppy analysis in this case. Corporate customers buy long distance, and they buy special access service. They buy the long distance service is provided over long-haul facilities that run between cities or metropolitan statistical areas, MSAs. And business customers use long distance for data and voice. So business customers have long distance data networks, not just toll-free service or Watt service or some of the long distance voice services that are more familiar. Special access services use exchange facilities, meaning facilities located within an MSA, to provide private line, point-to-point dedicated circuits. This is the kind of terminology that you'll see in the cases and the FCC decisions. So we're talking about point-to-point private line circuits that corporate customers use as the building blocks of their internal private networks. Corporate customers use special access to connect locations within an MSA and to connect their private corporate network in that MSA to their long-distance carrier, to the node of the long-distance carrier's network in that MSA. So, for example, banks will use special access to connect all their ATM branches, their secure, private, dedicated circuits. And then they will order special access to connect that network to the out-of-state database where the account information may be located. Or auto manufacturers will use special access to connect engineering and design centers to their assembly lines within an MSA, but they'll also use it to connect to a long-distance network that keeps them in touch with their dealerships around the country. And finally, for business customers, special access is both a retail service in the sense that business customers buy it directly from the ILEC for their own use, And it's a wholesale service in the sense that business customers buy it indirectly from long-distance companies who buy it in turn from the ILX as an input for the services that they provide. There are two key differences between long-distance and special access. First, special access circuits connect locations within a single MSA, within an exchange. So they are geographically specific services. This means Verizon's provision of special access in Buffalo does not provide a bank in Sacramento with a competitive alternative to AT&T when it's trying to wire up its ATMs.
Since you mentioned Verizon versus AT&T, wouldn't there be an odd regulatory disparity if the FCC had come out the other way in this case, with Verizon already having obtained the forbearance?
One I hope that the commission would resolve
in the rulemaking.
Yes. And there may be procedural complications there. I the commission will have to craft something that passes muster in the Administrative Procedure Act for clawing back any forbearance that was granted inappropriately.
Isn't the key to the case, I realize this may not square with how you all have divided the argument, but isn't the key to the case the DS1s and the DS3s?
Yes. If the commission erred in concluding that there is competition in local markets based on long-distance competition, that's an error that, the commission wants to refer to the DS1, DS3s in kind of a no-harm, no-foul way. Well, sure, maybe we looked at competition in a different market to conclude that this market's competitive and deregulated, but you won't be hurt because you can get these.
Right. To the extent there are competitive problems in this market, it's solved by the DS1 and DS3.
And that, for business customers, that's telling them you may need arteries, you may need optical carrier OCN, OC192s, you may need sonnet rings, you may need really big pipes within an MSA to handle your traffic and your data load, but we're going to give you a bunch of capillaries, and you can just tie them all together and make do. I think what we said in the brief is that's like telling a freight forwarder, you can string a bunch of VW bugs together instead of being able to buy an 18-wheeler for your containerized shipping. There are reasons why business customers need big format pipes, and that is that there are data services and data protocols that require a lot of capacity.
Of course, the commission relied on some of TWT's own statements, right, on this issue.
The commission relied on a press release.
Paragraph 26.
Don't find it shocking that companies in their marketing materials might describe their services more optimistically.
Right,
than
I understand the clash between the marketers and the legal division.
It used to be called puffing of the wares in the old three-dimensional
puffery,
world.
Yes. And as a representative of corporate customers, I won't fault them for doing that. The second difference between special access and long distance is that long distance service has been competitive for years. And in fact, the ad hoc committee led the charge to deregulate long distance markets when they became competitive. But that is not true of special access. Only the ILEX provides special access, except in the core downtown areas of a few cities. And even in those areas, the ILEX is typically the only facility-based competitor to most buildings. So the competitive alternatives that a corporate customer has would be an ILEC or other carriers reselling that ILEX facilities. In the order on review, the commission lumped these services together under the broadband heading. They did not examine marketplace data for particular exchange access markets, even though the staff asked carriers to supply that information, and which the carriers refused to do. Instead, the commission relied on decisions concerning residential internet access, in which the FCC used a single nationwide market to evaluate broadband services, the undefined broadband services. These residential internet decisions are inapposite. As historic and unprecedented as the rise of the internet may be, it is no reason for the FCC to lose sight of the many humdrum building block services that business customers have used for years. Those depend upon the availability of special access facilities and have nothing to do with the internet or the residential broadband deployment policies that so preoccupy decision makers these days. Business customers use legacy facilities. They may be boring, but our plea to the FCC is let us not be dazzled by the internet and forget about the services that have been around for decades. The order is also inconsistent with this court's precedent and the very FCC decisions that it cited. This court has recognized that geographically specific and exchange-specific nature of special access since at least 1988, when the court reviewed the access charge decisions that came out of the commission in that decade, and described special access as private lines that link an end user to an exchange carrier's location in an exchange area.
Unless my colleagues have questions, we've run out of your time. So thank you, counsel. We'll hear from Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, I'm Chris Wright representing the carrier petitioners. I appreciate it if the TDM-based issue is, in fact, the key to the case, because that assumes that the court does understand that it was a gross error for the commission to look at national markets and not local markets. As the Justice Department has said, the market for special access is no smaller than a building and no larger than an MSA, but it's reasonable arguments can be made for using different segments in there, but there is simply no basis on which you can look to a national market to decide whether special access markets are competitive. So I'd be happy to answer questions
on that.
Now you need
to deal with the harder issue,
good,
though.
Good, good.
The DS1 and the DS3.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me say that it is common ground that it is technically feasible to start with a TDM-based circuit and provide advanced Ethernet service. Let me quickly get in that AT&T told the commission, and this is at page 308 of the joint appendix, that the other forms of service, ATM and frame relay, are legacy services that are being supplanted by Ethernet. Those are AT&T's words. The others are legacy services and supplanted, and we certainly agree with that, and it's not only AT&T said that, the record said that. So it's technically feasible, but we have at page 26 to 31 of our opening brief a detailed argument based on statements in the record accompanied by sworn declarations that show that while it's technically feasible to start with a TDM-based circuit, it is not economically feasible to provide Ethernet service that way, except in extremely unusual circumstances.
And that's where the commission made a judgment, a predictive judgment perhaps, that it would be economically feasible.
Your Honor, I don't think the commission grappled with that at all in its order or in its brief. I think it relied on the puffery in the press statement.
Yeah, it relies on that. It's that paragraph 26, I think.
And let me just say, well, look, it just seems to me that it's obviously not reasoned decision-making to say that a statement in a company's press release trumps detailed statements accompanied by sworn affidavits explaining that while it's technically feasible to use TDM-based circuits, it's simply not economically feasible. And sort of you talk about conclusory, I think this is the height of conclusory. We'll rest our argument on the following. If you go back and read pages 26 to 31 of of our brief, opening brief, and follow on with a few of the cites to the joint appendix and the record, and think that the FCC's response is anything but conclusory, then I suppose we lose. But it simply is not an adequate response. And it's simply not economically feasible, as explained there. What
about the other half of this, I suppose, was the backup complaint procedure that will be available, expedited complaint procedure. How relevant is that in our deferential analysis?
Well, Your Honor, it's not particularly relevant. The FCC has forborne from the application of dominant carrier regulation. We honestly, and it's forborne from its pricing regulations in Part 61 and 69 of its rules. The FCC doesn't have pricing regulations of any teeth for a non-dominant carrier. The pricing regulations that are important are in the pricing flexibility rules, from which have been forborne. We don't know how we could prove that prices weren't just and reasonable. They
right.
wouldn't
Without
be
in, that benchmark, you're saying
they wouldn't be in violation of the regulations because the FCC has forborne from the regulations. We think it's obviously unreasonably discriminatory for the ILAC to require us to use the TDM-based circuits when they would never use them themselves. If they're going to offer Ethernet service, they don't put the TDM-based circuits on. They put the Ethernet circuits on. And let me say that we'd be perfectly happy to just buy the circuits without the TD. It is the TDM-based electronics that they're forcing us to buy that really cause all the problems, the unnecessary expense, the reduced bandwidth, and all those results. So we think that's obviously discriminatory. But if you read the FCC's decision, they plainly don't think it's unreasonably discriminatory to make us rely on these TDM-based circuits. Finally, the FCC is forborne from the discontinuance regulations as well. So it's not very hard for a non-dominant carrier to discontinue service. Now, we, of course, will complain if they simply refuse to do this, but once again, we don't have a regulation on the books that applies to a non-dominant carrier that we can have confidence will protect us here. Respond to one argument that AT&T makes when it said that that there's not a separate market for Ethernet, that there's a larger market for broadband enterprise services of the sort ad hoc members buy. That proves our point. Once you understand that the other parts of the market are legacy services, as AT&T says, that are being supplanted by Ethernet. Right now, TW Telecom, for instance, has a respectable 14% share of this market, but that's because it's deployed its own facilities where it can do it. So it has a 14% market share.
Who does?
TW Telecom.
Okay, thank you.
One of the petitioners.
Yeah, I just didn't understand what you said.
Sorry. And it has 72,000 ports in service for Ethernet. There are more than a million frame relay ports out there. TW Telecom is if it has to rely on the buildings it can reach to provide Ethernet service, its 14% share goes down to less than 1% once Ethernet supplants frame relay and ATM. So that's a point that really helps us. There are no further questions. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Seeing none, we'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Richard Welch representing the FCC. I'd like to make three points here at the outset. The first is that the FCC's orders involving these packetized services and these optical services are consistent with Section 706 of the Act and the congressional command of the FCC to make sure that these advanced broadband-type services are deployed widely throughout the United States. The second is that the FCC's decisions here are consistent with administrative precedent that has been affirmed by the courts in looking at these evolving broadband markets on a broad basis, on a national basis. And I would place particular emphasis in this court's decision in the Earthland case.
In the residential markets.
Pardon?
In the residential markets.
That's partly true, Judge Kavanaugh, but not completely true. On the internet side, that was true. On the unbundling side, in the 271 broadband forbearance order involving unbundled network elements, that was both enterprise and residential. And then the third point that I would like to make.
That's not the dominant carrier regulation, but.
Correct. The third point that I would like to make is that the carriers who are challenging these orders today lose nothing as a result of these orders. And let me expand on that a bit.
Right. They lose the protection of those regulations that are forborne.
That's true, but they never relied on that input in the first place. And let me try to expand on this a little bit.
Any company
who wants to try to provide these types of services to end user customers has to put together a variety of components to have the network and provide the service. It's no different for the ILEX than it is for the competitive carriers. Now, a competitive carrier like Time Warner Telecom, for example, everybody has to find what I'm going to call the local connection, the connection between the end user's locations, the bank facilities, to the network. Everybody has to find that piece. The commission made findings in this order that the competitors have a number of options for finding that piece, starting with self-deployment. And, in fact, they do self-deploy in certain circumstances.
Hardly ever.
No, I think that's an exaggeration.
To rely on that's a little much.
I think we'll come back to that in a moment. I think they can self-deploy if the volume is there. They can get it from third parties.
Right.
And they can retain unbundled network elements from the incumbents. And then they can take other inputs from the incumbents. And there are basically two that they could potentially get. And I'm going to call them input one and input two, and I'm going to try to do this in plain English. Input one is what you were speaking of, Judge Kavanaugh, the legacy pipes in the ground, DS1 and DS3s. And they have been relying on those. There's record evidence to that effect. They rely on one today, and the commission made a finding that they will continue to rely on them in the future. How did these orders affect input one? Not one whit. They left the existing regulatory regime unchanged with respect to DS1 and DS3. It's subject to the full panoply of Title II. It's subject to dominant carrier regulation, and it's subject to computer threat.
Why did it leave that unchanged?
Well, the carriers didn't ask for forbearance from those pipes. I don't know. We can ask them why, but the request for relief did not include the scope. Input two that they potentially could seek from the ILEX is Ethernet service itself. They could take Ethernet service from the ILEC, put a few of its own things together, and then provide an end-user service. They have not ever taken that service to any degree whatsoever. So the fact that the commission deregulated that service to an extent here doesn't hurt them. All the commission did was peel off the top layer of regulation that applies only to ILEX for this service, dominant carrier and computer inquiry, peel that off, put them on the same footing as these competitors, and for an input that they don't even use in the first place. So how does that harm them? And in the course of doing that, it made public interest findings that it was in the public interest and would help consumers to peel this layer of regulation off to make the ILEX more efficient competitors, to make them more be able to package tailored offerings to large customers, to be able to respond to competitors' offers more quickly without having to put them in a tariff, put them on a table, and let their competitors look at them for 14 days before they enter the market. The commission found that would increase competition in the marketplace and would hence help consumers. So doing this public interest balance, peeling the layer off doesn't hurt the carriers, and it helps customers.
What do you say to the argument that the commission focused on too large a market by looking at the national competitiveness rather than the local market?
I think there were sound reasons for applying the national approach in this case. And it starts with the FCC's decisions and the court decisions in this case. The commission has a long line of decisions, in both the internet access context and in the unbundling context of looking at emerging broadband markets on a broader scale, in fact, a national
scale. On the last mile into businesses, there's nothing emerging, is there? I mean, it's a monopoly.
It's not on the scale. It's certainly not on the scale of internet access, I'll grant you. But there is self-deployment going on. I mean, Time Warner.
Self-deployment is an expensive and not always available alternative.
That's right, Judge. The commission, again, found that there were a number of options available, including DS1 and DS3.
The only thing you seem to be resting on is the Time Warner statement, which is not a compelling
statement. Actually, it's more than just that. There is record evidence that the competitive carriers were using DS1s and DS3s before this decision. If you look at Verizon comments at JA406, AT&T comments at JA248 and 249, Bell South comments at 269 and 70, they all say these carriers have been taking DS1 and DS3s from us. Now,
You're not answering Judge Kavanaugh, at least in a way that I can understand it. How do you move from special access, which when you look at it, you look at what the Department of Justice has said, you look at prior cases, special access is local markets. And you have a national market analysis, and their word games in the commission's opinion just kind of blur it and make, if we say it enough, we say broadband enough, it'll make it go away.
Well, in addition,
you pretend there's no such thing as special access, which everyone understands, and no one assumes that that is something you can measure as a national matter competitively.
Judge Edwards, the commission was looking at these services and how they are provided in the marketplace. And they are provided on a nationwide basis.
Special access is a last mile kind of service.
It's an input into the national service that's being provided.
I don't even know what that meant.
What does that mean? You have to talk in the order.
Well, you have to have, as I mentioned in the beginning,
it can still be local only.
As I mentioned in the beginning, you have to have components to put together this package, and the commission found that
there are bus services going to airports in most cities, and there you would measure the competition within the metropolitan area. And the fact that they are taking people to go to planes that go from city to city tells us nothing about the competition within the locality.
I understand your point.
That's exactly what we're talking about.
But the commission did not ignore the so-called wholesale aspect of the market here. It looked at it and found that these competitors have a number of options, including the provision of DS1 and DS3.
What about the argument that those are aging or legacy technologies that are not going to be competitive in the future?
You're referring to which?
DS1 and DS3.
DS1 and DS3. They're working right now for Time Warner. Time Warner is the third largest provider of this service in the country, and they're moving up. They're gaining ground on AT&T. AT&T's market share is heading down. Cox, a cable operator, has now become the fourth largest provider of this service. So it's working I should be more specific.
Yeah.
Of Ethernet service, which is the service that they have focused on exclusively in their brief. This is a competitive service of the provision of Ethernet, and these problems that they are alleging do not seem to be holding them back. There was some discussion about puffery in this and what the carriers are saying out in the marketplace. I would suggest to you that's a very serious thing what you say to large customers. If you tell them that you can provide them a service and they sign up for it and you ultimately can't come through, your credibility is shot and you've lost their business forever. So I think it wasn't just the press release, it was the evidence in the record that says they have been providing this service by using DS1s and DS3s. Those provisions, again, are unchanged as a result of this order. They still are subject to the full panoply of Title II regulation before and after the order. So with respect to this input that they have successfully been using, nothing has changed.
That's your sole answer, as best I can tell, to your measurement of competition incorrectly on a national as opposed to local. You didn't get the information you requested, so you really don't know what's going on competitively locally.
Well,
so your only answer, it's not just fallback, it's your only answer, is the DS1, DS3.
No, I don't. I actually,
well, I'm not getting it otherwise.
Well, they self-deploy. They can get it from third parties. They can take unbundled network elements from the incumbent LEC. There are four or five different options laid out in the commission's order, how they can provide this service. In particular, we're focusing, we seem to be focusing on Ethernet
service.
That's
the justification for not looking at the correct market to determine the nature of competition.
I think the commission did take a look at it in conjunction with its look at the retail market, Judge, and to the extent that they're arguing that you have to demonstrate a fully competitive wholesale market before you can forbear under Section 10 in the retail market, that's flatly foreclosed by the commission's decision in the 271 forbearance order and this court's affirmance of that in the Earthlink case in note 8. It flatly said you do not have to make such a showing in order to forbear in a broader broadband context. So,
magic word.
What's that? Broadband? Let's call them what they are in this particular case, which is packetized services and optical services. This Ethernet service that we're talking about today, I mean, there's some suggestion that these are, they've been arguing that these are legacy services. Absolutely not. This Ethernet service has evolved rapidly in recent years, and this gigabit Ethernet service, which is now sort of becoming important in the marketplace, is a real cutting-edge service. It's exactly the type of service that the commission wants to encourage by this deregulation, by peeling back sort of the regulation on the asymmetrical regulation on the ILECs to encourage investment and innovation in these types of networks and services.
Can I ask two procedural questions? Where the rulemaking is still pending? There's a proceeding still pending on special.
You're referring on special access?
Yes.
There was an NPRM issued back in 2005, and that is still pending. You're correct, Judge.
Okay. And second, the Department of Justice is not involved in this case?
They did not join this brief, and they filed a letter with the court saying they take no position. So we think that the commission was fully justified in finding that dominant carrier regulation was not necessary to ensure just and reasonable non-discriminatory rates, not necessary to protect consumers, and was in the public interest by doing away with this asymmetrical regulation, putting everybody on an equal footing, and enhancing competition so that it would...
Asymmetrical? What was asymmetrical?
Asymmetrical, in terms of the Ethernet service, is that the incumbents before this order were subject to dominant carrier and... computer inquiry rules while their competitors were not. And let me say why that's important. What's so onerous about dominant carrier regulation from the perspectives of the incumbents?
Don't have the lines, right?
In some cases, that's true.
In almost but all cases.
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration.
Well,
I think there's some...
It's in the 90s.
There's some evidence in the record. Well, I'm not sure whether it's confidential or not, so I don't want to say it out loud.
Yeah. All those numbers keep getting blanked out in there.
I know. Believe me, if it were up to me, there would be no blanks in any of these briefs. The thing that's so troublesome, the thing that's so troublesome and led the commission to conclude that the dominant carrier regulation actually provided sort of negligible benefits here in the public interest is that there is price regulation, but there's this tariff requirement where whenever you're getting ready to come out with a new service, you have to post a tariff at the FCC and wait a certain period of time before you can enter the market. And all your competitors get to see it ahead of time, and they can sort of react and try to block it before you get in the market. Think about if an incumbent LEC came up with the latest version of Ethernet that was faster, greater, better than anything we had ever seen before. Prior to this order, they would have had to lay that all out on the table about what they were getting ready to do for their competitors to see. Now, what kind of incentive is that for them to invest in infrastructure and the types of things that we're talking about here? They're reluctant to do that. We think by the forbearance in this order, we have given them the incentives to compete more deeply in this area to the benefit of consumers. I see that my time is almost up. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Your time is more than almost up, actually.
Oh, it sure is. I'm sorry.
But if my colleagues have further questions, we... All right. No, hearing none.
Thank you.
We'll
I would.
The intervener.
I would respectfully ask the court to affirm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the intervener.
May it please the court, I'm John Nectarline for intervener AT&T. I first want to address the question of the feasibility of facilities-based competition in business districts. This is not a new issue. The FCC has found for many years with respect to the types of links over which Ethernet is primarily used today, there is, in fact, robust facilities-based competition in downtown business districts. It found that in the Triennial Review Order. It found that in the 271 Forbearance Order. It found it here as well in paragraphs 24 and 32. These are the findings of an expert agency. And to see that those findings are correct, you need look no further than the market share statistics that nobody disputes here. So, for example, Time Warner Telecom's market share was increasing right before this order was adopted at the same time that AT&T's share was decreasing. How did Time Warner Telecom do it? It did it through facilities deployment primarily. By its own admission, it was not purchasing Ethernet services as inputs from ILEX. It was building out its own network in downtown business districts where, as the FCC found, the bandwidth needs of consumers more than compensated for the capital investments needed to deploy those. Who else is on the top five list of Ethernet providers nationwide? Cable companies are. Cox, now Time Warner Cable, in addition to Time Warner Telecom, are. The reason is that they, too, are facilities-based. They are increasingly deploying their own facilities out into small, medium, and now larger business districts as well. So the FCC looked at the snapshot, saw that this was a dynamic market with robust opportunities for facilities-based competition, and that is the primary basis on which this order rests. I want to talk a moment about the issue of national versus geographically disaggregated market shares. The most important distinction in this case is not between local and long distance. That is an outdated legacy distinction that no longer has commercial significance. What matters is a distinction instead to the FCC between legacy TDM services, which remain subject to heavy regulation today, and package-switched advanced services, which the FCC has sought to promote through regulatory forbearance. Section 706 of the Telecom Act requires the FCC to draw that distinction and requires the FCC to remove regulatory obstacles to deployment, as it did here. So in order after order, the FCC has distinguished between legacy TDM facilities or legacy TDM capabilities and advanced packet switch capabilities, sometimes over the exact same facilities. If you look, for example, at the Earthlink decision, which is the most important decision for this court to consider in this case, there were arguments in that case. Even, first of all, the broadband services at issue there involved both residential and business, as Mr. Welch pointed out. Even with respect to residential, there were arguments in this court that the FCC erred in adopting a national market analysis because, according to the challengers, there were wide swaths of America where you could not count on cable companies to provide any competition at all to the telephone companies. So, according to those challengers, telephone companies were transmission monopolists in rural areas throughout America, they said, as well as small business districts. They said in those areas, the FCC was required to maintain legacy regulation. The FCC said, no, this is a dynamic market. Our distinction is between TDM and advanced packet switch services. We're going to follow that distinction, and we're going to adopt a national market analysis. This court said, we affirm. The Third Circuit affirmed the same national market analysis in connection with the wireline broadband order as well. And Judge Kavanaugh, you asked before, didn't the Earthlink decision involve unbundled network elements rather than services? Two responses to that. One is the Time Warner Telecom decision out of the Third Circuit, which involved the wireline broadband proceeding, did in fact involve for the elimination of the equivalent of dominant carrier regulations. In fact,
that case was purely residential, right?
That case did involve, well, it involved, the FCC has a distinction between mass market and enterprise. Mass market can include some business customers as well. That is correct, but the point remains that in both that case and in this case, The challenge was the FCC didn't adequately take account of the many areas, according to the petitioners, where there wasn't adequate facilities-based competition. And the FCC prevailed in that case in the Third Circuit in adopting a national market analysis anyway, despite that, because as the FCC found and the Third Circuit affirmed, it's appropriate to do a national market analysis in contexts like this one where the market is highly dynamic.
In saying Earthlink's the most important decision, what do you make of Earthlink's distinction of dominant carrier regulation? Because that was raised to the court in that case, and the court said some of those precedents were raised to the court in that case, and the court said, well, those were dominant carrier cases.
Two responses to that. One is Earthlink was decided before Time Warner Telecom, and in Time Warner Telecom, again, that was a case in which the FCC employed a national market analysis to eliminate the equivalent of dominant carrier regulation. Number two, from a real-world market perspective, it doesn't matter a great deal whether we're talking about dominant carrier regulation or facilities on bundling requirements. In each case, we're talking about the extent to which regulators should intervene in the market to force a set of carriers to provide access to their networks on highly regulated terms. And in each context, the FCC has to decide what sorts of investment disincentives those regulations create. One further point.
Quickly, you are over time.
With respect to the DS1 and DS3 issue and the feasibility of running Ethernet over DS1 and DS3, I just want to touch on that briefly. I don't think that's critical to the outcome. I think to the extent it's important, there is, in fact, substantial evidence in the record to support the FCC's judgment on that. It can be found in the CASTO reply declaration, which the FCC cites and appears to Joint Appendix 44 to 46. You can also look at the Verizon October 9th, 2007 ex parte at JA 40607. And I think given the existence of that substantial evidence, the FCC acted more than within its discretion in crediting the statement of Time Warner Telecom itself that it had successfully rolled out Ethernet service over TDM circuits.
You say it's not critical because of the facilities-based
opportunities. That is correct. Okay. That's correct. Thank you.
Yeah, how long for rebuttal? Well, we're going to treat this together. How much time would there be all told for rebuttal? Pardon? 2 minutes. Let's give 2 minutes to each of counsel for rebuttal then. Go ahead and take it, counsel.
Just two quick points. From an end user's perspective, special access is not just Ethernet. Ethernet is a tiny piece. Our brief spent a lot of time talking about Ethernet because the FCC did in its order. But for end users, the legacy services of ATM, Frame, Sonnet, Optical Carrier are just as important. And that is where we told the Commission we're looking at a 94% monopoly on the part of the box in terms of facility-based services. These are services we've been using for decades, and we are continuing to use them. So Ethernet is really not our issue. And the second quick point is on the Earthlink front. There is a significant difference between unbundling and dominant carrier issues, and from our perspective, from the ad hoc committee's perspective, perhaps one of the most significant is that end users can't use UNIs, unbundled network elements. They're only available to carriers. Our only option for these services is special access. And if the Commission concludes that the ILECs are non-dominant and removes all of the regulatory protections we need in an environment where we have no competition, then we have a real problem. And that issue, the issue of how competitive this market is versus the impairment issue for unbundling, which is can competitors enter without access to unis, those are very different issues. And the Commission could conclude that competitors don't need to enter a market with unbundled network elements, that they're not impaired, at the same time that same market is one in which the ILECs dominate by virtue of their market power. And as end users, our question to the Commission is, what are you going to do to protect us from the ILECs market power while we're waiting for the competitors to enter? And yes, the Commission has predicted competition was right around the corner, has based its deregulation on those predictions. It did that in 1999.
We're out of time again.
Okay.
We'll hear from Mr. Wright. Go deliver the benediction.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two quick points. Mr. Welch said we don't lose anything because we don't buy much Ethernet from the ILECs as it is. It is true that we need to win twice. We need to win in this case, and we need to get more regulatory relief in the special access rulemaking. But if we just get better rules and they don't apply, that won't do us any good. A quick point, the CASTO declaration and that sort of thing, they just say that it's feasible to use TDM-based electronics. We don't dispute that. We say it's not economically possible. Mr. Nectarline talked about there being a lot of competition in downtown business districts for special access connections. There is some. We have a different view, but that's where we ought to be looking. This court should send the case back, and we can argue about which downtown business districts are competitive and which aren't. And some of them probably are, but most of the country isn't, and that's why looking at a national market was such a big mistake here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. The case is submitted. Give us a recess.